This talk is going to give us an early history of the entire Montauk program, some of its background, what its agenda was with regards to the Montauk time tunnel and mind control.
There is a hidden agenda we'll have to get into, too.
And the hidden agenda. So why don't we start with the beginning of the Montauk Project with Mr. Al Bielek.
The Montauk Project, as we like to call it, because of its location at Montauk Point, did not originate at Montauk Point. Its origin actually goes back a few years prior to that, actually to about 1946-47, when World War II was over, and a lot of German scientists were brought in from Europe under Operation Paperclip, some of whom wound up with the CIA, some wound up with various other agencies. CIA, of course, for the record, only was formally entitled to be called that by a charter signed in 1947 by President Truman. But many of these scientists came into the U.S., and a lot of them wound up working in various projects under government behest at a well-known laboratory on Long Island, Brookhaven National Laboratories. Now, Operation Paperclip pulled in thousands of people from Europe, mostly Germany. Now, many of these scientists have been working on various projects in Europe and in Germany prior to the ending of the war, and they've continued their work. The primary and principal agendas, as I understand it, and as we were pursued at Brookhaven for approximately 20 years, was one, time travel, and secondly, mind control. To go back a little bit earlier than the arrival in the United States, these scientists were working in Nazi Germany on these projects there. They were working on time travel. The Germans allegedly did have a functioning time travel system, though I have not seen anything I would consider sufficient to call it a positive fact that they did, but those are the rumors. They were working on mind control. There's very strong evidence to show the what type of equipment they were using at that time, though it was an earlier phase of it. All of this hardware and experimental work was brought to the United States by the same scientists who worked on it, and it wound up at Brookhaven. Brookhaven, I might also add, quite aside from the fact that they're well known for nuclear medicine and other rather clandestine research projects, which today includes a repository of alien bodies and aliens alive and dead and crashed UFOs and a lot of other strange phenomena, all of which was occurring simultaneously, because Brookhaven is a very large operation and has a lot of money supporting it. It is basically a tax-supported structure, though I'm sure there's a lot of clandestine monies arriving there under the table from various other government sources. But the fact that it is publicly supported by tax money means they must make monthly reports to the oversight committees in Congress and the Senate. And this went on for years. Excuse me. This went on for years, the monthly reports. Nobody read them in Congress or the Senate, but they kept doing their research. That is, these German scientists were doing their research at Montauk, and this went on into the 60s. And nobody knows really what they were doing until eventually someone started reading these reports in the mid to late 60s. And they were reading things like mind control and this sort of thing. And they said, mind control? These guys might use it on us. Pull the funds on that project and also kick the guys out. That was the orders that came down from Congress and or the Senate. So these scientists were given their notice they were to leave. So obviously they were looking for a new home. Now, parallel to this, a little further east on the island was a place called Montauk Point. And at Montauk Point, there was an area called Fort Hero. Fort Hero, of course, was an established military base that goes back to the beginning of the 20th century, to about 1900. Its actual history in those first years is a little bit obscure, but we know that they did establish an army base as well as a submarine base, underwater entrances for submarine pens, two of them. So the Army and the Navy were established sometime in the first decade of the 20th century at Montauk Point. Fort Hero was an operating base, and it became a little better known during the period of World War II because they put in coastal defense works. They had a large military installation there, the extreme eastern tip of the island. They wanted to defend Long Island in case the Germans, I'm sure they didn't expect anyone else, decided to try and invade the point. They never did, of course, though German submarines did come up there during that period, literally charging their batteries off the point during the day. And their crews would wave at people on shore, and people on shore wave at the crews, and it was rather a strange war when the German subs came up in enemy territory, and nobody ever shot at anyone, and nobody did anything except wave at each other and be friendly. It was a strange war indeed in many respects. The war ended. All of these scientists wound up at Brookhaven, and eventually they were kicked out. So they were looking for a new home, and the new home turned out to be Fort Hero. They went out there, and of course, in addition to the Army, the Air Force arrived sometime around 1948-49 to work on some very interesting projects, quite legitimate and quite in the open, namely the over-the-horizon radar project, the first one, which was the one known as the SAGE project, the first attempt to develop a radar system powerful enough to read objects over the horizon. It was successful. It was installed all around the U.S. One installation was made right there at Montauk, and that, of course, was the original experimental one. And then, of course, they came up with a later one, the BMUSE project, which was a follow-on. And this was, of course, conducted in the Air Force section of the base using the same radar tower and all the other peripheral buildings and hardware they had. Got into some very powerful hardware in terms of radar systems and the driving systems for the dishes. And this went on until approximately 68, when BMUSE was considered successful and was installed in Canada, and they started to phase out the SAGE systems. Well, at that point, 68, they were considering phasing out the SAGE system, but before it was shut down and phased out, the scientists from Brookhaven arrived and gave a pitch to the military there. You might be interested in the research we're doing. We're looking for a new home to continue our research. Well, what are you doing? Basically, we're working on a program which we know you would be interested in. Well, what's that? Well, suppose in a future war, you had an enemy that wanted to attack you, and you could push a button, and electronically, you could shut them off. In other words, they suddenly decide they don't want to fight you anymore, and the war's over. Nobody fires a shot. Well, they liked that idea, the military personnel, and they said, yes, you may come on our base and continue this research. We're very interested. And, of course, this was the idea of mind manipulation and getting an enemy to surrender by the push of a button on certain very exotic electronic systems. This was demonstrated and used in the Gulf War in 1991, I might add. In any case, in 1968, the system didn't exist yet. But they were welcomed out to Montauk, and they moved in the surface installations, and at a later time underground. But that becomes another story a little bit later on. But they first moved in on the surface and continued their research in mind control and in the time research. And the military essentially, but not totally, moved out. When the Air Force shut down, they largely moved off the base. The Army retained some presence, and the military off and on retained a presence there. But officially, the base was closed and considered surplus from 1968 onward. It was held as a surplus base in terms of the War Assets Administration in Washington. And the story circulated after that point that they were going to turn it over to New York State and make a park out of it, demolish the buildings, perhaps keep the radar tower and convert it into a restaurant. There were a lot of rumors circulated over a period of time. But the Parks Administration did become involved to the extent that they partially took it over and officially sanctioned it as the area which was under control of the New York's Parks Administration. That became a very convenient cover for supplying the money to keep the base operating at a later time. But in the period after the military officially moved out, they didn't totally, but the Germans stayed on. And they continued their work on this base and, of course, basically took over all of the operations. Now, in the period from about 1968 until 1976, many things took place. The military had to expand their operation. The civilian group, the Germans, had to expand their operations. The military shrank their operations. But the military retained a presence and an interest because they wanted to see this project continue. And, of course, it included the Navy now. They got interested.
Al, did the military actually fund the project, or did they have their own funding?
This was a point of great confusion for many years after it was over, and became the basis for a major investigation to find out who did fund this project. There was no money put in by the military. There was no money put in by Congress or the Senate, as subsequent investigations proved. And all of the research there, after the military moved out, was actually funded by the German group themselves. But it was funded in a very strange way. Now, we have to go back again to World War II. In 1944, as Germany was starting to collapse and they were losing the war, there was a lot of money being transferred out of the Reichsbank into various places. Switzerland was one of them. But there was a special railroad train containing Reichsbank gold, which was sent into France. And in 1944, this particular train was dynamited in the tunnel, killed about 51 GIs. And the gold on that train, reputedly $10 billion in the gold at the value of 1944 in Europe, which was not $300 an ounce. It was in about somewhere around $25, $28 an ounce, as I remember. That gold disappeared. And one of the principals involved in the research as to what happened to it, why did American GIs get hit with an explosion in a tunnel on our side? This was not on the German side, but on the French side. What's going on here? None other than General Patton got involved in this investigation. Well, he knew, of course, there was gold on that train. It disappeared. They never found it. And he never found the answers to who was in back of this. But he continued his investigation, and it would appear from all of the data that we have, there were those in the Army who were in on it, and it was an inside job, obviously. But he never got, that is, Patton, never got to the bottom of who was involved and why this happened. He eventually paid the price for his investigation. He allegedly, according to the public story, died in a car accident in an ambulance later. And the story, as we understand it, was that he was actually killed and made to appear like an accident because he would not give up on his investigation of who was involved in this train bombing in the tunnel and what happened to the $10 billion in gold. Well, jump ahead 10 years. The $10 billion in gold turns up from the information we got much later, and this information, of course, to put in context, turned up in the 80s. But in any case, it appeared suddenly on a ship off of Montauk Point in 1954 in a storm which sank, and scuba divers went out to the ship and recovered the gold which had disappeared from this railroad train and stored it at Montauk to be used in future operations. At that point, 1954, of course, Montauk was not involved in what we call the Montauk Project. But it was stored there by apparently the military. And eventually that money had a highly inflated value, of course, from 1944 to 1968, was used to fund the project. It was used to pay all the bills. It was used to buy all the equipment because a large amount of equipment had to be designed and built according to the German scientists who at this point were now working with aliens. In 1954, to put in a little more into the background, there was a treaty signed, the Greata Treaty, by President Eisenhower and a group of aliens at Edwards Air Force Base in which we agreed not to interfere with each other's civilization, but the key point which has bearing on the Montauk Project was that there was an agreement made that we will give technical assistance to each other. Now, one may ask, what could we do for the aliens, meaning that they had technology so far ahead of us that that was the cause for the treaty being signed at the pressure of the military to President Eisenhower? They could give us a lot of help. We gave them some help, which was more in an area totally outside of our discussion, other than to say that it was genetic and biological. But in any case, they were able to give us a lot of technical aid and assistance in other areas. The Germans of themselves were working on time travel. Time travel apparently was partially functional with the Germans during the end of World War II. I might add that the United States also had, in great secrecy, a working time travel system which dated back to 1936-38 period, which came under a project name entitled Project Southern Cross. I'll have to jump out of context if I tell you how I found out about that. But I knew about it. I did not know about it as Al Bielik, but I knew about it as Edward Cameron. In any case, a system was available to function, but the Germans didn't know a thing about it, and they were pursuing their own ends. And at the time when they became involved at Montauk to expand this project, the project director, who was assigned as a technical director, Dr. Hermann C. Untermann, who was a German himself, and came to the United States in 1938, thanks to my father, my real one. He was a project director, and he was told, among other things on this project, which was under government supervision and oversight, and included all of the intelligence agencies giving oversight, that he would have to learn to work with aliens, that there would be aliens involved in this project, as it transpired from 1968 onward. They would become technically part of it, giving technical assistance, because the, shall we say, the premise for the whole thing, which the government wanted, and the charter, if you will, the bottom line, was they were to explore a time and space to the fullest extent that was possible, using technology which came out of World War II, which came out of the Philadelphia experiment, which came from the Germans' knowledge, and which came from alien intervention and alien technological assistance. Obviously, the aliens knew much more than we did. They knew how to time travel. We knew how to time travel to a limited extent. But they also knew how to do something else, how to transport oneself from point A to point B instantaneously. No rail lines, nothing else in between, but literally transference from point A to B through, shall we say, hyperspace, a wormhole, whatever you want to call the technology. They knew exactly how to do it, and they said, you can build the hardware, and we know you have that capability, but you don't understand the theory. We'll tell you how. This was part of the cooperation. So they moved in on the Montauk project, and they became a backbone of it in many respects, because the agenda involving the time tunnel, which was to be a, shall we say, a two-phased project, not only time travel, but space travel, i.e. from point A to point B, whether it be on this planet or off this planet, as was later the case, that hardware was very complex and required an understanding which we did not have at that time, but the alien groups gave us. And of course,
give us an idea, Al, of who the alien groups were, because there's many, many out there.
Oh yes, there are many out there.
Which ones worked with us on this project?
The ones that worked with us on this primarily in terms of the computer expertise was a group called the Leverons, who were perhaps a subsection of the Orion Confederation, from the Orion Confederation, the Orion Constellation. And from there you also get the Reptilians, but the Reptilians were not directly involved in the project. Some of them showed up occasionally. We also had some of the Tall Grays involved, which had a, let's say, some minor contribution. There was a very heavy contribution by a group from Sirius A. They were known as the merchants of the galaxy, the hardware builders for the galaxy. If you wanted a spaceship, they knew how to build it. If you wanted some other specialized hardware, computers, whatever, they could build it for anybody if they negotiated the price, whatever it may be. And they became involved in the project in terms of building much of this hardware, and also became heavily involved with the mind manipulation operations.
Did they all seem to get along with each other, or did they stay apart?
Basically,
from each
they
other?
All got along with each other because they were under a directive which said they will get along with each other, because many of them normally would not.
Yeah. And who do you think created that directive?
It is hard to say exactly who laid that directive down. But the coordinator for all of this, the person who was in charge of all of the alien objectives and all of the alien contributions, was a Draconian. Stood about 8 feet tall. Actually, he was a little more than that, about 8.5 foot tall, 450, 500 pounds, from Dracus Major. Extremely intelligent, very arrogant type, who lost some of his arrogance as time went on. But he was a coordinator of all alien parts of the project and alien contributions. And he coordinated the alien efforts and the alien connections. The intelligence groups also were in on this. And the, shall we say, the particular corporation which coordinated all of the hardware building and the requirements technically from both the alien and the human side was ITT, ITT Corporation, which, because a result of all of this, was broken up. But that came much later. But they were high in the saddle at that time, you might say, and they were the principal coordinator, helped get the contracts shipped around to various companies in the United States. There was Corning involved in it. There was Westinghouse involved in it. If I recall correctly, RCA, ITT heavily involved. AIL was involved. A couple of computer corporations were involved. All of the contracts for the various pieces and hardwares and systems were handled through ITT Corporation as the principal coordinator. There's an interesting thing about IT&T, which we learned later on, was that it was a wholly owned subsidiary, if you will, of a German group, the Krupps. The Krupps owned 53% of the stock of ITT at one time, at least during this period of time. Therefore, you can say the whole thing went full circle. The Germans started it in a sense, and the Germans were operating it in another sense in terms of the financing.
Can I go back? Was it the Germans that actually sent the scuba divers out there to get the gold, or was it our Navy people who retrieved the gold? Who was that?
That recovered the gold?
That recovered the gold.
It was our Navy people. It was Navy divers, because it was a Navy installation out there, and it was quite easy for them to send us regular Navy hard hat or scuba divers out. The ship wasn't deep enough to be a hard hat. They could do it with scuba.
So then why didn't they just return that gold to the U.S. government? Why did they hide it at Montauk?
That's a very good question. Who authorized Montauk operation in the first place? We don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
There are aspects of this we have no answers for.
Mm-hmm. And this is just one of them.
Right.
Okay.
So the alien agenda was to provide the technical expertise required to produce the time tunnel and also to help with the mind manipulation, mind control aspects. And this went on so that during the period from 68 to 76, they were building the hardware to create the time tunnel, or the Montauk tunnel as we came to call it. A great deal of hardware had to be designed and built on station, off station, moved in, and, of course, expand the operations. The major operations are underground, not on the surface, though some of it was still used on the surface. And the principal time tunnel that was developed, this phase two of it, was underground. Phase one was actually above ground and used the old radar tower. The original phasing of the system required the use of an RF system, very high-powered, and the whole radar tower and all of the equipment above ground fell into this very naturally and was modified in order to be able to do this. Needless to say, they had a lot of failures and a lot of problems. Of course, some of the hardware didn't work and some of the approaches weren't exactly right, and they had to use computers that we had available, which were, of course, at that time period, the IBM 360s and the 370s, and later on after 76, of course, the Cray 1. But in using the IBM's computers, we had a great problem. We wanted to interface with alien computers, which were brought in to Montauk, in order to provide the data backup and the data manipulation and to be able to handle the whole system, because it was extremely complex and the mathematics involved was incredibly complex. I don't know if anybody other than the aliens fully understood the mathematics. I knew I might have been able to understand the math as Ed Cameron. As Al Billick, I definitely did not. Because as Ed Cameron, I had a much better grasp of math than I do today, or even during that period. Mm-hmm. But in any case, to understand it required the alien concepts, the alien ideas, those and the technical staff that could handle the math and build the hardware. Our computers could not handle it, so they ran into a problem where they had to convert a lot of their data into a format which the IBM computers could accept. Later on, there was some help from the Cray 1, and of course, as anyone knows today, the Cray Corporation is up to Cray 6 or Cray 7. If we had had a Cray 7 available then, there would have been absolutely no problem interfacing with the alien computers. Probably a Cray 5 could have done it. But that didn't exist at that time.
You interfaced with alien computers?
We tried it. It didn't work.
I see.
So the aliens had to provide IBM data cards and other forms of translation of their mathematics into a format which would fit and work in our computers. And that took almost 10 years. It took from 68 until 76, and actually a little further into that period, into 77. But eventually they got it to work.
Okay, for our listeners, though, there's a name that we hear associated with this project, the Phoenix, Project Phoenix. Was, to your recollection, was that the name of the overall project there at Montauk?
The overall project at Montauk was under the Phoenix Project heading. Project Phoenix came into being approximately 1953 and was actually used as a cover for the ongoing Invisibility Project, which had gone through several name changes, actually. It started out as Project Rainbow, then was Project Mirage, and then in 53 they changed it to Project Phoenix. Phoenix was a huge cover, if you will, a huge tent to cover many different projects, and it's still in use today as that, under that name. So, yes, Phoenix was the cover for that.
So you'd have Phoenix 1, Phoenix 2, Phoenix 3?
You could well
like
have, yes, and it probably was for that project because it right. went through many phases. It's the original one, as they had it, which was using the radar tower as the element for focusing the energy in order to produce the tunnel effect, the time tunnel or the time transfer from point A to wherever. And I might add, for the basis of those who don't understand it, well, did they have a receiver at the other end? No, they did not. It was a very interesting and unique system, and this is why the aliens designed it this way and why apparently they knew how to do it and we didn't. We would have thought about, we got to have a transmitter here and a receiver there, which says you got to have a receiver at every point where you want to go. It wasn't necessary with this system. The tunnel became the transceiver, if you will. You go in at one end, all of the equipment is at one end, and it focuses the energy on down to whatever point you choose to have it go to, and the product, or I should say the transfer, whether it's hardware, material, personnel, or both, will go through this tunnel and materialize out at the other end, not actually dematerializing in the tunnel, but going through what you would call an extended artificial wormhole, and will come out at the other end, wherever they wanted it. So, and the reverse would take place if you wanted that person, group, or hardware to come back. You reverse the phase of the thing so it would pick them up from that end and bring them back to Montauk.
So you're talking about actually fulfilling one of the goals of the Montauk project, and that was to build this time tunnel, right?
Yes.
And when do you think that time tunnel was actually completed, built?
The first working system that was tested, from my recollection, was right around 76. It might have been slightly earlier, but 76 was the point where they were doing their first experimental work. Now, I might add, in prior to that, there was another aspect of this, which was sort of overlapping and, of course, was in a partial sense independent. And that was the use of the Montauk chair and the psychics to see whether or not, through the computer systems and understanding of reality, you could make a thought reality. In other words, have somebody sitting in the chair, whether it's Duncan or someone else, think of an object, and could you create this through the computer system and the understanding of reality as the aliens gave it to us and we put it into our computers? Could you take a thought and make a physical object out of it? If a person thought of a chair, could they create a chair through this transmitter system as an actual physical reality? They did. They were able to do this quite well. At first, when you shut the transmitter off, the thing disappeared. It was a non-permanent thing. Mm-hmm. They finally determined how, and they were able to make a permanent object.
Well, what are some things that were actually thought into an existence?
Typically, they thought of a chair. They thought of a table. I don't know what other objects they might have thought of.
Gold?
They could have. Mm-hmm. They could have thought of a number of things. It was more or less of a game at first, just to see whether you could do it. And when they found out they could, it stopped there because the next phase beyond that was, of course, to see if you could transport an object through the tunnel system. Mm-hmm. And that was, of course, the main goal.
So was the chair the first part of the project for the time tunnel? You had to develop the chair first, and then you were ready to develop the time tunnel? Or did they work together?
Yes, you worked together, but you also had to have the chair and the computer electronics working in the earlier phase, which was the reality manipulation or create a real object from a thought form. Mm-hmm. that was a precursor to the whole thing, because if you could do that, it meant then you could undoubtedly modify this thing so that an object, if I can say it this way, an object could be, in a sense, transferred into a thought form and sent down the tunnel and recreated the other end. That was some of the original thinking. But it actually came out that the tunnel was refined to the point where you sent the object physically with no alteration right through the tunnel to the other end. You didn't have to uncreate it, such as in Beam Me Up, Spock, or Beam Me Down, mm-hmm. in the Star Trek model. Atomize it, put it into some kind of a waveform, and recreate it at the bottom end.
Just throw it in the tunnel.
We just rode right through the tunnel without any alteration.
Give our listeners a sort of a picture view of what this chair looked like with all the gadgetry around it.
The chair was very much like what you would envision as a captain's chair on an aircraft, maybe a dentist chair minus the dental appliances, a comfortable reclining chair which could be tilted and you could recline comfortably, because the operator in that chair, who was a very sensitive psychic, had to be comfortable. And they weren't strapped in. They were just laid down in the chair, and they would tilt back, and they were put into their proper operating state. And around it, in fact, the chair would have coils wound into it for picking up the body energies, and the early system used a form of antenna, very much like a Delta T antenna. And I want to say Delta T, let me describe what a Delta T antenna is. Envision a pyramid like the Great Pyramid of Egypt with a apex up on top. Then take away the pyramid and just look at the four corners, like you had four rods coming from the apex down to the base, and around the base you had four more rods in a square in the actual shape and form of the pyramid with the same angles. Now this would be a device where you had the form, but in addition to the form, you had coils wound around it.
Isn't that half a tetrahedron?
Perhaps you could call it that.
Yes.
Because in the original form, we only used half of them, of the Delta T. Actually, it was the one-half section. The full Delta T required coils and XYZ axis, where you had the two of them base to base, so that you had two apexes out here, and you had the two bases facing each other. But that was not for pickup. That was for another purpose. To pick up the energies of the psychic in the chair, you had one conical pyramidal-type structure, which was wound with coils for energy pickup. They weren't to put any energy out. They were to absorb the energy coming out from the psychic. They did it in many ways. They tried many different systems, but basically it was to pick up XYZ coordinate energies from the person's head, because the human head does radiate energy, both electric field and magnetic, and you had to pick these up with very sensitive amplifiers. They used cryogenic amplifiers at first. They had to have very, very low noise levels. Then they finally shifted to something which was picking up certain specific bands at RF.
How far away from the subject's head were these devices?
The coils were basically within 2 to 3 feet of their body. As far as the head was concerned, they wanted to get them as close as possible, so typically they're about between a foot and 18 inches.
So the psychic didn't wear a hat or anything?
No, they did not wear a hat. There were some experiments done with that, using a helmet. That didn't work too well, because it was too uncomfortable with the psychic, and if they were uncomfortable, they didn't function properly. They had to be completely comfortable. They had to be in a state of reverie, and you couldn't have any physical distraction from that state. And a helmet was a physical distraction, and anything too close to them is a physical extraction, because they can sense the coils out there if they're too close. So that was a setup, and there was XYZ coordinate coils. These energies, which were very low level, but nevertheless there, were amplified, and they went through their own processing system, and eventually they were fed into the computers. Now, how did this work? You can't just pick a psychic up off the street, pardon the expression, but pick up a sensitive and psychic and say, we're going to train you to do this, and have them sit down on the chair, have them think of something, like, for example, creating the chair, a physical chair from the person's thought form. You can't just say to the psyche, think of a chair, and then automatically a chair appears, because the computers will not of themselves understand the person's thought processes. The person has to think, if you pardon the expression, in computerese. They have to think in a form which the computer recognizes. Now, this required additional training. All of those sensitives, all of those chair psychics, if I may call them that, had to go through a very special training process in another location down off the shores of the Potomac, which we call the Potomac Facility. It was called by various names. But in that facility, there were some very special training processes, and it was, I don't know how long that place was in operation. It's still in operation today, so far as I know. But it was there at the time when we needed it. And what it did, it took people in, put them through special computer training systems, high-speed training, plus capabilities of exciting and improving the thinking capacity of the brain, which required certain chemicals being injected into their systems, and going through literally five phases of this kind of training. If anyone has seen the movie, The Lawnmower Man, that is exactly the kind of facility I'm talking about, because that was based on the actual facilities of the Potomac that we had down there. Yeah. And I went through it because I had to know exactly what these guys were going to go through, made some improvements on me. But it was cut off at a certain point. They didn't want the people to go too far.
Are you saying you actually went through that
facility? I went through the training facility itself. I went through the training so that I would know what Duncan and all the others had to go through and what the effect was. So theoretically, I could sit in the chair and do the same thing.
Did you ever go in the chair yourself?
I don't recall that I did, other than for a test program just to see if the equipment was working.
Okay.
However, they had to do this because what it did, it gave them the ability to understand computer language, whatever form you wanted to use, whether it's COBOL or any of the others.
Yeah, how in the world do you think like a computer?
You don't normally. That's the problem.
That's what I'm trying to...
Normally a human doesn't, but you see, if they put them in the proper state of reverie, you access their subconscious, plug in a certain program, a series of them, in fact, it's mind control of another level. It's mind control where they're not controlling the mind. You're giving the mind new abilities.
So
that the person can think in the normal form when they're in their normal state of mind, that is normally conscious and talking like you and I. Mm-hmm. But if they were to be used for this program, they were put in a special state of mind where they accessed this training in the subconscious, where any thought that they were given, any idea which was presented to them, was converted into a computerese format. As I say, whether it's COBOL or any other program, didn't matter. Whatever the program they wanted to use, it came out of their minds in the subconscious level. This was picked up by the coils, and this was understandable by the computers. They had to think in a computer language. And this was done at a subconscious level, not the normal conscious level.
And to your knowledge, about how many people were trained that you worked with to run this chair?
There were at least six that I know of, but I was told there were a lot more than that as time went on. I would give an estimate, because it was not everyone that could be trained to this. They were specially selected to begin with. I would give a hypothetical guess at this. It's about 20. I knew about six. Mm-hmm. But there could have been more. There could have been less than that.
Is Duncan the only one that you remember the name of?
No, there was one other that was used in that program. In fact, there are three I know of that were used in that program. One I have more or less track of today. The third I've lost track of. Another man that may have been involved in that program I've met occasionally in Long Island, but he became involved in some sight issue because some of these guys had multiple talents. In fact, some of these people using the chair did have multiple talents, and they used them elsewhere. They didn't believe just using a single talent. If you were multi-talented, they used them all. One of them, as I think of now, was a guy who was known as the drummer. He was in one of the bands down there. They had some very good musical bands that did a lot of recording, but this had nothing to do with the chair, except that some of the people in the chair had other things they did. Hmm. Some of it was for pure recreation.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Do you want to keep those names sort of quiet at this point?
Basically, yes, at this point.
Okay. Now, another goal or agenda for Montauk was mind control.
Yes.
And we'll get back to the chair. First of all, on the chair, you interfaced it into computers, basically, right?
Yes, the chair interfaced the computers.
And
from that, the person who was in the chair was given instructions
right. As
to what they wanted to do that day or that session. Like, let's say they wanted to run a tunnel over to Tibet. I'm just being hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time as today, the today of that particular point, they could, in their mind, think of the tunnel is going to go to such and such point in Tibet. They would be given the coordinates, and the equipment would be turned on, and the person would think about it. The tunnel would open up, and then, of course, the tunnel would terminate at the other end in Tibet. And if they wanted to send a person through to do some exploring or send a truck there with something, they could.
Where would the tunnel physically open up?
The early work on this, but not the important work, the early work on this was using the radar tower with an RF system. Excuse me, using the...
You're talking about that big radar tower?
The big radar tower with a huge antenna on it, which at that point was still servo-controlled.
Mm-hmm.
They've long since lost the capability of steering it. But it was servo-controlled. They could focus it down towards the ground, and the distance was sufficient to the traffic circle, which shows up in the series of pictures I've done,
mm-hmm.
was a focal point. And... if they wanted to transport a person somewhere or an object, we put in that traffic circle. The antenna would be fed the appropriate RF signals and so forth and all of the corrected aspects. And that person or object would be picked up, transported, and go through the tunnel to wherever it went through. This was not too good. It was sloppy. And it wasn't a true tunnel as we used it later.
Did we... burn up a lot of people?
They burned up people. They burned up equipment. People and equipment disappeared in hyperspace, shall we say, and were never recovered. They had a few accidents like that in the early days. They finally decided the RF system was not the way to go, and they converted it to the tunnel as we all knew it from about 1978 on in the underground, where they built two back-to-back Delta T antennas in two forms. The usual form was that they had the two bases of the pyramids, if you will, back to back. There was another form they used where the two apexes of the pyramid were point to point on a straight axis. In other words, they weren't tilted in relationship to each other. They're on a 90 degree axis, a straight zero axis to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they used apparently both of these. They were driven with their own coil systems, and I don't know the whole configuration. In fact, I know very little about the configuration of the electronics for generating this tunnel, but it worked in that they were embedded. Believe it or not, these Delta T antenna systems were embedded in the rock underground. How they got them in there, I don't know, unless they chiseled it out and then filled it in later.
Hmm.
That aspect I don't know or understand, but when those things went on and you got a green light on a certain piece of equipment, there in the room, if you will, where the tunnel would suddenly appear, the wall would disappear and you would see this tunnel, approximately 8 feet in diameter.
Was that physically close to the person in the chair?
No, it was not close to the person in the chair at all. It was quite a distance away.
Wow.
Because they didn't want the radiations from that tunnel affecting the chair personnel. Actually, the chair person was on the surface, usually in a room or a building on the surface.
Oh, not underground?
No, this tunnel operation was all underground.
But the person in the chair was above ground?
It was, at least initially, as I remember. Now, whether they ever moved him off the ground level, I'm not sure.
Al, who in their right mind would ever volunteer to be a subject for the early testing of this time?
That is a very good question.
I mean, they see the guy in front of them gets zapped out in hyperspace, never to come back. Who would raise their hand and say, okay, I'm next?
That was a problem in the earlier phases. I am sure some of the subjects of these early tests were not volunteers, just as the Montauk boys in the early phases were not basically volunteers. They were sort of booted into it.
Seems like, though, they would do a dog or a cat or something like that.
They did do that at first. They did use some test animals.
But why even use humans until they know the system had been perfected?
Well, they assumed it was working properly at the first times when they used the humans, but things happened after it was turned on and everything looked like it was functioning correctly and all the meter readings said the proper things, but you can't tell whether that tunnel went all the way to the point where you wanted to go or even if it was terminating where you wanted it to terminate. You couldn't be sure in the earlier runs whether that thing was stable in the middle. And this was the problem. You could be transported down there and suddenly they hit a point of instability and you go, they're gone. They're atoms in space. Or the tunnel could be functioning properly all the way through and develop an anomaly while it's operating after somebody's in the tunnel. It was not instantaneous, point A to point B. There was a finite time period. It was a matter of anywheres from seconds to maybe possibly a minute, depending upon where they're going or how far they're going. If they're going across the galaxy, as they did later, that could have been perhaps about 2 minutes in subjective time, possibly even on a wristwatch, for that matter.
Well, as you know, I interviewed Preston Nichols, and he said that he actually went through one of these time tunnels into the future. Said it was the worst experience he ever had. He wanted to die.
I remember him saying that once.
he said it was he was compressed down to nothing. It hurt like hell, and then boom, expanded out again. And when they brought him back, he said, "Don't ever do that to me again." Now, was that pretty much the common experience for people?
Not as I remember it. That was probably an early phase.
Okay.
There was a lot of, shall we say, improvements of the system as time went on, a lot of modification. In the last 2 or 3 years, it worked very smoothly. From about 1980 on, it worked very smoothly without any of these kind of problems. I don't recall that there was any compression as you went through the tunnel. But then again, if I or an object were going through the tunnel, you might not be aware of it. Now, Preston was. Something was wrong. Whether it was wrong in terms of the tunnel function at that time or one of the characteristics of it at that time, what he reported was not what was usually reported, as I recall. So he might have been an early anomaly in terms of the functioning, or it could have been something particularly about him because he is himself a strange hybrid. He is human, but he's also a little bit more than human because he's been off-planet, and he's been worked on by the Pleiadians, and he admits this in one of his books. And he was at one time very ill, very sickly, the typical sickly kid. They don't know if he's going to live or not. Mm-hmm. And suddenly he was healthy as a horse. Somebody worked on him. What else did they do him besides improve his health? There might have been something done to him which created the problem for going through the tunnel. I can only say that as a hypothetical idea. I don't know if that was the case, but something caused him to have some terrible reactions. I don't remember anybody else reporting this.
So about what year do you think they moved to the Delta T antennas?
That was about 78.
And where did that technology come from, to your recollection?
As I understand it, and Preston said this, basically that's Pleiadian technology. There were Pleiadians there, but they weren't there very often. And there was a special group of Pleiadians which show up occasionally, just as there were groups of other aliens that showed up occasionally who didn't seemingly do much or didn't spend much time there. There was a group of little grays that showed up periodically. They didn't do much of anything except get underfoot. There was a group of very human-like aliens from Antares. Couldn't tell them from a human. They were totally naked. They looked like a human. They didn't do anything. They were very friendly, but they didn't seem to do anything. Whether they were there strictly as observers, I don't know. I don't know what their reason for being there was.
Well, they probably just didn't have a reason to interface with you, so that's why you saw it as them not doing anything.
That could well be.
Well, one of the other comments was that everything is very compartmentalized in this operation.
Very true.
Could you comment on that?
Things were very compartmentalized, not 100%, but largely. The more sensitive areas of research were highly compartmentalized. The Montauk boys were not, as such, allowed to know what was going on in terms of the tunnel operations. The people went through the tunnel operations because of other things they worked on, such as myself would know about the Montauk Boys, and I knew about the music rooms. I used to wander into them because that was recreation. It was on limits to anyone. The genetic research, I knew very little about, except there was some going on there. And I believe that got out of hand and was moved off the base because it was interfering with the main goals. There was a lot of genetic research done elsewhere that I know of, but that's not what we're discussing here in terms of Montauk. But there was a lot of compartmentalization in the sense that they didn't let any one specific person know everything except the station manager. That is Jack Pruitt. He had to know what was going on in all respects because he reported to the next up the line, who was the technical manager, who was down there once in a while, and that was Herman Sienterman. He was the technical director of the project. He reported to somebody else up the line.
Do you know who that was?
No, I don't know who the next in line was because I had occasion to go through the whole chain once. And the person above him was a man by the name of Dr. Clarkson, as I recall. And there was the man who was at the top of the whole administrative heap of this thing, whether he was stationed also at Lincoln Labs in Boston, Mass. Area or not, I don't know. But the top administrator, I never got to meet. I may have known who he was then. I don't now. But what his function was, since the man I did interface with at one point was very high up in the chain and appeared to have authority over everything except that he had to make phone calls occasionally, which meant there was somebody over him. The upper levels of that chain of command, I don't know what function they served. I don't know who they reported to. Mm-hmm. But there was a chain of command. And the one occasion I had to go up to the next to the top, and that was at the time when I changed the whole Montauk Boys program, which we can get into later.
Okay. Now, give us a visual tour of what the Montauk base looked like.
Okay.
Both above and below ground.
Above ground, there's a lot of photos to show this, but above ground, if you were to drive out to the Montauk base on Highway 27A, I believe, is the one that goes through the town and is another 5 miles to the point, you would come to the point where the road goes around in a circle and there's a park there. You would park your vehicle. And assuming, as it was from the period of 1983 to about 1993, it was almost totally open on the surface, you could walk through that little park, find a section where the base gates were down, and walk in and walk all over the base. On the surface, there were a lot of military barracks and a lot of military buildings, which were leftovers from the time when the Army and the Air Force and the Navy were there officially.
Did the Army Corps of Engineers originally build that base?
Probably from the beginning. The original base was built around the period of 1901, 1902. I don't have any records of that. And it constituted a surface base and apparently one level underground. In the period around 1930 to 33, the Army Corps of Engineers got in big time, and I saw the plans for that at the time of a meeting we had out there, which was in May of 1986, with people who were involved with Senator Barry Goldwater, who sent his own little investigative crew out, brought the plans for the base with him. Highly classified, I'm sure, but he was allowed to have them, and I did look at them. And they showed that, at least as of that time, there were six levels, one on the surface and five more underground. These were built by the Army Corps of Engineers, the additional underground bases, in the period around 1930 to 33, and they built them in a very unusual way. They built them above ground, as it existed prior to that 1930 point. And when they were done with all of the construction, all the steel, concrete, and everything else, they built a hill. There was, they poured earth, huge amounts of earth in on top of everything, covered it over, planted trees, bushes, shrubs, whatever, to make it look like it had always been a hill there. And you can see from the driving out from the town that there is an artificial hill there. And if you get the right point, you can see there's a hill, which doesn't seem to quite fit the terrain, but it looks very natural. And that was basically how they built the base up. The original surface works were buried underground, and they built a new surface function, if you will, in that period around 1933. And, of course, during World War II, it was heavily occupied. And only a few people, I'm sure, at that point knew there was anything underground. But that's what you would see walking around on the surface. And to get to the underground, there were walk-in entrances in certain buildings, some regular stairways. Then the radar tower, there was an elevator that went down to all the levels. It was a very large freight elevator. It could carry approximately a ton load, and perhaps more than that. All of that was available, and if you went down to the underground, as we did at more than one point, there were various levels, and as we called it in the basement, which was a lower level of the underground, they had all of the power conversion equipment, all the very heavy electronic equipment, which they wanted down there in the basement for shielding and for other purposes. And occasionally, if the cooling requirements got heavy enough, they'd flood it with seawater. The equipment could be flooded with seawater down there if they had to. And occasionally they did do that, which is not normal. It was below sea level.
Okay, when you went below level, what did it look? Was it very plain? What were the walls like?
In some areas, are very plain concrete.
Like cylinder concrete blocks? Or
no, it was poured.
Poured concrete.
Poured and reinforced with steel.
Okay. No decoration or anything?
The only decorations that ever showed up there was what the personnel put up as time went on. Like comedy relief, some kind of relief on bare concrete walls, graffiti, if you will. There was not much of that.
So at the end, how many total levels were there underground?
Six at that time, and they built two more since then, and that was in the period between 1983 and 87. As I understand it, there were two more underground levels built since, so there's eight levels underground today. But up to 83, there were six.
Did you ever go down to the deepest levels?
Yes.
And about how large would you say those lower levels were?
In terms of ceiling clearance or
in terms
how far
of
they extended?
Width, yeah. How far they extend?
Ceiling level was typically about 12 foot because they might have room for a lot of equipment and cooling and all of this. But some of that equipment generated large amounts of heat. Extended for hundreds of feet. In fact, I would say that the bottom two levels extended for over a mile. It was quite extensive. And they merged with natural cavern systems because under Long Island, as part of even the Montauk operation, there were a lot of natural caverns which sort of faced onto and actually joined into. The artificial constructions actually merged into the natural cavern systems.
Did they use technology to build this underground facility that we don't have access to today, or is this something that they can easily do right now?
This is something you could easily do now. And the technology of the 30s was quite up to building what they had down there in terms of just the structure. The equipment was moved in later was another matter, but the structure, there was no problem in building anything we had there. Like any bridge building or tunneling we could do in the 30s, in fact, earlier than that, in the turn of the century, any of that type of technology would have been sufficient to build the physical facility of the underground Montauk.
Was it moist down there?
At times it was.
Cold?
At times it was, but other times it was hot, depending on how much equipment was running.
Where was the ventilation then? I mean, that would give it away.
It's a very good question because they hid the ventilators very well, stationed around various parts of the mound, if you will, in the center of the island, the center of the base. There were ventilator shafts, but they were well concealed. In some cases, they came out into other buildings on the surface.
Yeah, well, that would make sense. Okay. So sort of a plain. As I think of it, like an army base, everything's very plain inside.
Very
there.
Plain is true. Even the buildings on the surface that were used, and as we examined them after it was over, but even before it was over when we're actually there, the buildings were plain military, and any garnishments was done by the personnel who lived there.
At the height of its operation, how many employees would you say or people were actually working at this Montauk base, both above and below ground?
They had a fairly large office staff, which were civilians brought in, sworn to secrecy, of course.
And that was above ground?
That was all above ground.
Right.
They had considerable offices. The office I worked out of, there were about 50 people there. I would say the total civilian personnel at the peak of operations was probably around 200. And that was a pretty good staff to keep track of and to keep quiet.
So there were 200 people below ground?
No, this was above ground as office staff.
Okay, 200 above ground. How many below ground?
That varied from time to time. That was hard to know unless you had access to all the facilities, so I'll have to take a second guess on that and hypothesize it's probably around anywhere from 300 to 500.
That's a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, but remember, it's a lot of space, a mm-hmm. lot of area down there, and there was multiple projects.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So how do you keep all those people?
I didn't.
Wow.
Well, yeah, that was Jack Pruitt's job. As well as those who worked under him.
Oh, was Jack one of his responsibilities to make sure nobody talked?
It was his responsibility to coordinate all of the efforts. The civilian personnel, all the personnel who were brought in, had to be passed by him. Mm-hmm. They had to go through various screenings, not only physical screenings, but, of course, psychological, security, all of that sort of thing.
But didn't they have the technology to sort of wipe your memories clean?
Very much so.
And so you think they ran everybody through that program when they're done with them?
When they were done with them, were about to leave, whether they were told that your job is over or whether they decided I want out. In any case, they had the debriefing, which was, of course, erasing their memory of anything they did there on the base.
And do you have any recollection of how they actually did that?
It was electronic equipment. How they did that specifically in terms of the equipment was very similar to what was used on the Montauk boys later on. At the early phases, there was hardly anybody that left. Later on, there were people that started to turn over, let's say around 81 onward, there was turnover. Because the heavy construction was long since over, the electronic installations and construction was over, there wasn't much modification from 1981 on. And some of the staff was not needed anymore, because a lot of it was needed for just logistics, keeping track of equipment coming in, where it was going, was it paid for, issuing contracts and all of this sort of stuff. That required a rather sizable office staff for quite a few years. When they had it all built and it was all functional and there wasn't much changes being made anymore, then they didn't need that staff and it was tapered down.
You said hardly anybody left. What did they do with them?
Hardly anybody left in the early phases. Mm-hmm. Erasing their memories at that time, I don't know exactly how they did it, unless they used the old hypnosis and chemical injection techniques, which basically were scopolamine. Since there were a lot of Germans there, I'm sure they had their own techniques. Scopolamine, of course, was a German drug from IG Farben. Mm. Very effective with hypnosis to wipe memories.
But not as effective as this electronic means. Would they wire you up, or... What did that look like?
Basically, any of the techniques that they used later on was, and in the middle phases, was wiring you up into a machine which was much like an EEG machine, i.e. the pads you put on your head, little electrical contact pads on your head and various parts of your body in order to monitor the energies, and also not just to monitor what was coming out, but to put in an energy field which would put you into the proper state, a semi-orgastic state, where they wanted to wipe memories, not install memories, but wipe a memory.
Did you ever actually see this procedure being done?
I think I saw it once.
Okay.
But I didn't. I was not particularly interested in it, so I didn't stick around for it, because I had a lot of other things to do then. And, of course, eventually my turn came, the debriefing from the Montauk thing. But that was rather hasty and hurried, and the debriefings of the personnel after the project was down was not very thorough. It was nearly everyone remembered what had happened within 2 years to three at the max.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we've been talking about the Montauk time tunnel as one of the main goals for this project. Would you say that they were quite successful in their use of this tunnel?
Extremely successful. Probably more successful than they expected in their wildest dreams, because here you had a tool which enabled you to go to the moon and do exploration on the moon, or inside of you knew there was an inside and where to get into it.
So it was really a space-time tunnel.
Absolutely, a space-time tunnel tool, if you will, to explore space and time simultaneously. You could go up to Mars. You could go to any of the other planets. You could go to another solar system. You could go across the galaxy.
You could go to the Civil War.
You could go back to the Civil War, and they did.
And you can go in the future, right?
I'm sorry?
And you could go into the future.
Oh, yes, very much so. And you could, by using either Montauk or related facilities, because they did build parallel facilities, some of them were modified, as was Montauk, because there were other SAGE radar systems around the country. There were 26 of them. Most of them are later phased out. Some of them put into storage, but as the case was, there were originally 26 functional. So they had other facilities available to modify to the same format if they wanted to, and they did a few. So they had other facilities they could use, and some of these were used in time travel. What facility was used for going back and, let us say, looking at the Civil War and doing a number on it, I don't know. I don't know which facility. I know still today one of the people who was involved with that project. They could have used other locations for other projects, but as has been mentioned most recently, they used Montauk to take a look at World War II. It was, of course, long after the fact, but they used it to go back and look at World War II and see the outcome as it came out, as the history books recorded. Was this really the most optimum output and the most optimum way the war ended? And they looked at other scenarios and tried them out, apparently. What if, pardon the expression, what if Hitler had won the war? I don't know if they actually went ahead and tried that scenario out. I was not aware of it. I've heard of this from other sources since. But they could theoretically go back and do enough manipulation in time, putting the right people in the right places, to see to it that better information was given to Hitler, that perhaps he was cured of his ailments of 1941, and that he monitored his war efforts more closely and didn't make some of the foolish mistakes he made, he might have won the war. So if you manipulated so he won the war, what would be the outcome? This was what they were looking at. Was this a desirable thing? Would it have been better for us all the way around if he had won the war? Or suppose somebody else had done something different than they did?
Well, Al, I have to say that if indeed this is true, it's scary.
Oh, definitely it's scary.
Because it begs the question, what is reality?
Very much so. This gets down to a very basic question. What is reality? Whose reality?
Yeah. You've had years to pontificate on this, to think about it. What is reality? And in your opinion, what is reality?
Well, reality, as we accept it physically, the time of birth, the time of death, if you don't have the experience of going through a Montauk syndrome or a Montauk experience or anything near it. So as you were born, you live a physical life, time flows at an even rate, things happen normally. Everybody knows thinks they know what normal is. That you have physical laws governing reality and so forth, and time flows at a relative rate that's quite measurable. And you have a life, and eventually you die, and other people come along and so forth. And there are history books which record what's happened. This is what we accept as reality. Now, suppose, and I'm saying the supposed for a reason, I hypothesized that somebody could manipulate time so that, A, time doesn't flow at the same rate, or maybe time folds back on itself, or maybe your timeline, as you remember it, actually has a kink or two in it you're not aware of, and you did things you've totally forgotten or you have had erased from you. Suppose you live the equivalent of two lifetimes in one lifetime, but all you remember is the one lifetime, and I know of particular examples where this has happened. Then it becomes a case of what is reality. What you think is reality may not be reality at all, because you've lost memory of some things that you have done, because they were manipulated into, you were manipulated into not remembering it. Now let's look at it in another sense. Suppose time is not a totally linear function. Suppose that it's a closed loop. There are those who theorize this, including Einstein. He says everything is curved. We're living in a curved universe, and he said it himself years and years ago, that if you were to be able to go forward in time in what you think is an absolutely straight line, and were able to go far enough and fast enough, you'd eventually come to the point where you'd be hitting yourself in the back. Literally, you'd be going around an enormous closed loop, which is what he said. The universe is a closed loop. Time is a closed loop, and so forth. Therefore, what is reality? If you can go down that stream of time and look at it, yes, let's say 50 years from now, there's humanity there. Certain things have occurred and happened. Society may be much different than as it is today. But those people there would have a history of the past as to what happened from the point where you were. It may or may not agree what you think is going to happen. And these people may have false information. They may have real information. Now, suppose you can go forward to that point, talk to these people, and say, I'm from their past. This is what really happened, and so forth. And you have altered history in the sense of you have altered their conception of what has happened in the past. Now, suppose from our time, we could go back literally to the time, let's say, of the Civil War, and interpose ourselves as a group or whatever, and make certain changes in their history, then you could change the outcome of the Civil War. But then, so this but being then the case, then what happens thereafter?
Yeah, then you would have to immediately change what's in everybody's mind. For instance,
it happens automatically.
It would have to be automatic. Like, let's just say you went back to the Civil War and
you wouldn't know what happened.
You had a machine gun. Mm-hmm. You brought it with you. You gave it to one side. That one side was able to use it to their advantage and win the war. And now all of a sudden, I open up this history book, and on page 54, there's a picture of that machine gun that wasn't there a second ago.
Exactly.
Is that how it would work?
That would be essentially how it would work. You can manipulate history that way if you have the hardware and the capability and want to do it. Now, looking at this from this point forward, well, let us say, take it back 50 years. Let's take it back to 1945, when the war ended. And according to history books, we know how it ended. But let us hypothecate a world control group, which is not really so much of a hypothesis, but nevertheless, I want to say, let's hypothecate a world control group that wants to be able to control, from that point on, the outcome of history through the next century, from, let's say, 1945 to 2045. Now, we have hardware which says we can time travel, and that is perfected in a number of years from the point of 1945. And these people know it's coming along. They get control of this hardware. What is to stop them from going ahead in time, seeing how things are going to come out, and saying, this is not the way we want it to be. We want it to be this way. Then they go forward in time, and they do the manipulations, which are necessary, or they go backtrack a little bit and change certain people, certain groups. They may murder certain people. They may see that certain people are grown. They may see certain changes in science and technology are accelerated. Others may be suppressed. So that you shape history as it is going along to achieve a pre-desired goal.
But wouldn't it also be possible that they go back and say, kill the Antichrist, when the Antichrist is a baby, and then they zoom back up to the point where the Antichrist does all the trouble and they find out that nothing has changed?
That, I understand, happened.
You're kidding. I just made that up.
You may have just made it up, but I understand it actually did happen. Bill Cooper used to tell that story. The guy who used to lecture all over the country, excuse me, and hasn't anymore, got into the subject of time travel once, and I do not know now whether he made this as a public statement or at a private group meeting, but he said there were those who have played around with time travel, and the Navy hypothecated, well, we know who the Antichrist is now. The Navy didn't explain who it was, but they said, we know who it is. Why don't we go back into the past and murder his father before the father married? Therefore, if this is accomplishable and we can do this, the Antichrist should cease to exist. So according to Bill Cooper's story, they did this. They had the time travel equipment available, which I know they did, and went back and they assassinated the father of the Antichrist before he married. So theoretically, there was no marriage and there was no Antichrist kid born. Didn't affect the person they knew as the Antichrist. So at that point, the people who pulled this experiment went scratching their heads and finally went to some of the quantum physicists. They figured were the best possible people to come up with an answer. Said, what happened? What went wrong? They came up with an answer, which I can't say I fully accept. But nevertheless, their answer was, you're dealing with quanta of energy, you're dealing with quanta of space, of time, of everything. Consequently, you only affected the local area, and you didn't affect the outcome, even though you killed his father before he married, you didn't affect something else which has already happened. Now, this, to me, doesn't make sense.
Well, now, you know, his wife could have been pregnant at the time, too.
That's right. His wife could have been pregnant. Maybe there are other factors that he didn't know and we don't know.
That's right.
It's a very complex scenario, and I don't necessarily buy this quanta of energy at the time. Therefore, it's not going to be transmitted to the future because there's too much evidence of the contrary. Too many other people have tried this and have manipulated the future, manipulated time. I've seen things in my own lifetime that have taken sudden strange turns where, let us say, a piece of information I know I had disappeared under circumstances it cannot explain. Disappeared out of my files, disappeared out of a locked location. I know I didn't throw it away. I know nobody came in and opened it up. Why did it disappear? How? I can't explain it. I know other people have had the same experience. These usually are very critical, important pieces of information which somebody doesn't want to survive or to be disseminated, whatever the case may be. And people disappear. This is well known, of course, in the annals of the FBI. People disappear. What happens to them? Mm-hmm. We don't know. A million, as you said, 2 million kids, and more than kids, of course, disappear. Adults disappear. 2 million kids a year disappear. How many adults in addition to that, I don't know. And they find out about a few of them. Yes, of course they will. But they said about a million kids a year, we never find out what happened to them. And how about all the adults that disappear under mysterious circumstances? Nobody ever finds anything out about them.
Is the number that large? A million kids a year?
2 million.
2 million a year?
A year.
U.S.?
U.S. That's out of the mouth of the FBI itself. They don't put that figure around publicly.
Where did you hear that?
That came from Phil Schneider, who investigated. After I told him about the Montauk boys, he went to the FBI, among others. But the last one he went to was the FBI. And said, oh, yeah, we know about the program and so forth. And they came up with some very interesting statistics. They said, you, of course, have seen the pictures on the milk cartons and in the supermarket stores and all this about, have you seen this kid, that kid, and so forth, that disappeared? We want to trace them. He says, we keep track of all of them in the U.S. And he says, about 2 million kids a year disappear in the U.S. every year. He says, we find out about, well, approximately half of that, about 1 million a year, what's happened to them. He said, in some cases, we're able to locate them and get them back to their parents. In other cases, what's happened to them is you can do nothing about. They might have died and were killed in an accident, whatever. But it says there's a million we never find anything out about. No data, whatever.
That's a scary, scary
thing. And
this has
been going on for at least 20 years. Yes, it is a scary idea. And then to consider adults who also disappear, which, of course, the FBI eventually gets involved with. But it becomes harder to trace adults in many cases. Mm-hmm. There are all these stories about people driving down a highway, and I don't doubt these. Driving down a highway in a snowstorm, and that's the last anybody ever sees in the car, and everything disappears. What happened? Did they go into a time wormhole? Did somebody manipulate them out of existence?
Have you actually known people who this has happened to?
Personally, no. Mm-hmm. I have not.
You just heard stories about that.
I've heard stories like this, and it's well publicized mm-hmm. by people I consider reliable that these stories are not made up out of whole cloth.
Well, it'll be interesting for, you know, if there are people listening to this program, if you have some verification of these numbers, this data, we're going to give you an email address that you could send that to and put it up on Al Bielek's website. I think it'd be an interesting thing to keep going. Yeah, go ahead.
It would be interesting because not only in terms of kids who disappear, and of course the supermarkets do a good job of covering these now, mm-hmm. and I looked at many of these from the pictures, and I see something in some of these where I could see this smells to me like an abduction, whether it was a, quote, alien abduction, unquote, or whether it was a government abduction for some special program is hard to say.
But don't these abductions with the aliens, don't they usually return the person back?
Theoretically, yes. And I would suspect that in the cases of aliens, many more are returned than are in the case of where our government has picked these people up for special programs.
That's a sad thought.
That is a sad thought.
Let's get into the other objective of the Montauk, and that is mind control.
Well, that's a huge subject in itself. But
you also think, though, that the two programs were run independent of each other.
They were run independently, yes. The product of one could be used by the other, but nevertheless they were independent programs, mm-hmm. probably conducted by independent engineers and scientists who probably back in Germany worked on them independently also. The idea of the mind control, which of course the Germans originated in many respects, though of course the idea of mind manipulation goes back thousands of years, and we won't go into that history of the cult manipulation and the long drawn out processes by which people can be manipulated, and has been going on throughout history. But in terms of the modern aspects of mind control, we're talking about taking a person, altering their memory patterns, altering their memory of their own history, and conditioning them, not only for false memories, but conditioning them to be available to work on a specific project or to do a specific thing on command, which command is also buried with access by some kind of a keying system, regardless of what the keying system is. That's mind control. Mind manipulation is to precondition the persons to be interested in certain things and not interested in others, to be accepting, let's say, of certain criteria in a modern society, to accept, let's say, the way our government is going, or any government is going, towards more and more legal and otherwise control of people and a civilization. To be accepting of certain things which the government would like them to be accepting of, that's mind manipulation. Mind control means that this person can be taken over and used for something which may be totally against their normal desires or their normal inclinations, but by means of programming their subconscious mind, unknown to the conscious mind, to be able to do something on command, which otherwise they might never do, and which, of course, they have no awareness of they having been programmed to do this.
So was it the mind control that was the program being run there versus mind manipulation? Or
yes.
Both?
They were basically concerned with mind control.
Right.
Setting up a programmed individual, if you will, a programmed patsy, if you will, whatever, a person who is programmed to do certain things on command. Mm-hmm. And the command would be given, and of course, under that program, the person will do what they've been programmed to do, totally oblivious of their normal personality. It's like a wall is built, which quite literally it is, and you have on this side the normal personality, on that side you have the programmed personality. Now, to anybody on the outside of this individual looking at them in either state, they would recognize the same person, except it to be suddenly a total change of the personality. They would look the same, they would talk the same, they might appear to be the same, but they'd be doing something totally different than their normal personality would allow them to do, so to speak, and people on the outside can easily see this.
Now, were these called the Montauk Boys?
This was the aim of the program experimentally at Montauk. Now, mind control can be used on general populations and be elsewhere, but in terms of Montauk, they decided to see if they could set up a whole cadre, a whole class of people who were programmed, pre-programmed or partially programmed, as the case may be. In the case of pre-programmed, already set into them the commands and the instructions of what they were to do, or to what group they were to become part of and report to, or if it was a case of they were pre-programmed to accept further instructions on command, i.e., you get this command, you will call somebody and you will go somewhere as part of that program and then get the rest of the story, so to speak, as to what you ought to do. It could be a two-phase program or it could be all self-contained into one phase. But that person would have those primary or secondary commands buried in the subconscious and accessible only on command, whatever those command mechanisms are.
Any ideas of some of the things that were put into their mind to do?
Yes. As a result of having been in that program long enough and seeing not only then, but of course since, what some of these kids have been used for, they can be programmed to be assassins. They can be programmed to be agitators, riot makers. They can be programmed to be arsonists. They can be programmed to go out and shoot somebody on command, a la all of the school shootings in the age brackets of anywhere from 11 to 16, 17. This is all the same type of programming. And the conscious mind level, these people have no idea that they're going to do this sort of thing unless they are in a level where they want them to be aware that they're being used, and that actually changed the whole concept of that individual's understanding of society and understanding of their position in society, such as the two boys involved in the Columbine shooting. They were more Montauk boys, both programmed, but at the same time, they had to some extent an awareness of where they were going. And they were consciously setting some of this up, because that all shows in the records they left in the computers that they were planning this sort of thing. That was not a case of totally buried and somebody else pulling the strings on them. Yes, someone else is pulling the strings on them, but they're also acting to a degree consciously.
That brings up another question as to who is setting the agenda for the programming. Because someone has to say, okay, I need 5 assassins, I need 20 arsonists, I need, 15 agitators, because I'm trying to do something on July 15th and it needs to all come together. Someone has to have a big
absolutely
idea
true.
In their mind of what they're trying to do.
Absolutely. There has to be a master manipulator, a programmer, if you will,
right,
who is setting this up. In the case of the school assassins, the school assassinations, a long string of them, I do not know who would be a programmer for that and who would be coordinating it, particularly at this time. Back in the days when they had set up the Montauk Boys, I can only speak in terms of the programmers who put the programs into them. Now, who would watch them, who would keep the program going, and who would be, let's say, the master manipulator of these kids and the master programmer to use them? I have no idea at what level that operates or where that would come from.
So you were pretty much on an operations level, weren't you?
That's right. I was not on the concept level. I was not on the administrative level. Who in the secret government, because I'm sure the secret government would not be the open, legitimate government at all. But the secret government, of course, is very large and very much buried. Who in that would be setting these kids up and using them? I don't know. And who is being manipulating these programs? For what end and purpose, I can say yes, but for who, no.
It would have to be extremely, extremely elaborate.
Very. These programs operate inside programs, and they run through several levels of concealment, of cover, if you want to use the term, of several levels of laundering. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's not laundering money, it's laundering people, if you will, for their usage. Who is setting it up? That is laundered so that nobody can really find out.
Okay, so getting back to mind control, though, physically, how did they do it? There was sort of like two different ways, wasn't there? There was the initial sort of physical way, and then it moved into an electronic way. Can you describe that for
us? That's true.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.